David McKittrick from the University of Cambridge speaking on what will the library of the future look like.
I want to start off with a commonplace, and that is that it's not just our habits of research that are changing, it's our habits of reading that are changing. And I was reminded of this when I had a look at the Max Planck report of 2001 on reading habits amongst teenage boys in Germany. It was discovered that 40% of 15-year-old German boys do not read. Well, that figure is obviously open to all kinds of questions, but it is a reminder against perhaps too easy assumptions today that as we look towards the future. Perhaps even less easy for Germany is the fact that it was placed 21st out of 32 developed countries in its literacy rates amongst boys and girls of that age, all social backgrounds, all school systems. In other words, what do we mean by reading? What place has reading got in our lives? And what, therefore, will we mean by libraries, or will we expect of them? Well, closely linked to the questions that have been inevitably very widely debated in Germany since the publication of that report are questions about the future of public libraries in this country. I want to start with public libraries, as you'll see in a minute, for a particular reason. For the world of public libraries, the past few months have been dominated first by the Public Accounts Committee plea for more books in libraries, and then in July by the government's somewhat two-handed response, which has been welcomed as either judicious or hopelessly inadequate, according to lines both in people and in ideas that are all too depressingly predictable. Such questions about reading, and therefore about use, what we expect of libraries, what we keep in them and how we consult them, impinge directly on the look of libraries, how we manage space, how we manage expenditure. I propose in the next few minutes to do two things. First, I want to remind you of one or two recently built libraries, and second, to comment on how the design of these libraries is affected by the changing expectations and needs of readers, to whom the screen may be at least as important as the printed or manuscript page. I've deliberately begun with issues relating to the world not of academic libraries, but of public ones, for three reasons. First, they're an area which in the last few years has been much debated, where there's been all too often a stark contrast drawn between book stocks of a broadly traditional kind and the urgent need to provide public access to electronic resources. Second, this debate has often been poorly constructed. Thirdly, we are only beginning to see some of the issues that have been aired in it applied not just to public libraries, but in the future to academic libraries as well. Well, my brief is to look at the future of the look of libraries, so let's just have a quick look. I'm less concerned with recently constructed libraries for small special collections, such as that at Dove Cottage in Grasmere, where the brief was to make available to specialists in a secure environment the manuscript and printed collections there, and equally make available to be explained to visiting parties, the public, students, schoolchildren, and other people generally interested. Let's forget that one for a minute. Let's move from the country, let's move back into London. Let's go to Peckham. New public library at Peckham. Well, it's actually been open for a little while now. It opened in 1999. Peckham, as you know, is frankly part of much-needed urban regeneration. In case people are unsure of its purpose, this library has the word library in large capital letters standing on top of the roof. Other people have remarked that the end profile of the building, that looks rather like a capital L, turns 90 degrees, and resting on the extreme end of its short bottom lid. And here, in a building with a ground floor footprint that is rather less than half the area of the upper two floors that contain the library proper, the space underneath the library has been designed as a plaza, of a kind familiar enough in Manhattan, but less familiar in Peckham. The upper floors over this covered plaza are supported on stilts that are set at angles so that some people say it looks like a giant insect. It was designed so that people on the top floor could look out beyond Peckham at the surrounding townscape. Architecture apart, Not the least interesting aspect of this building is the choice of phrasing with which it's been presented if you look at various websites on the subject. Here's one, for example, from some architectural enthusiasts. Bold, imaginative, highly successful, both a striking example of community architecture and also a result of a client brief to redefine the role of the library within a modern community. It's a building that really enriches community life. In other words, books have not come in second, but third place, below social activity and inclusion, below computer screens. Oddly, given that books are heavy, the books are on the top floors. In supermarkets, I'm told, essentials are put towards the back of the store so that you have to walk past everything you might not want to what you really want at the back. If you go to Peckham Library, what's happening there? Well, the books are right at the top, past all the computer screens. Now, a cynic may wonder when the librarians are going to catch up with the supermarket managers. But there is clearly a question here of what you put at the front of your store, what you put at the back. Inside, apart from the omnipresent screens that reflect learning and information expectations, there are various pods. One for communal use, such as meetings, and others for children, the third for Afro-Caribbean interests, which of course are very strong locally. It's impossible not to engage with it as a building, to worry about what are being called the bizarre angles of the struts that support it. But more importantly, to find parallels, you have to go back not to the early public libraries in the mid-19th century, that made their own social, literary, and topographical statements of public investment, and were another form of social engineering, but to their predecessors, the mechanics institutes that combined teaching, meeting space, with collections of books. Very differently, Bournemouth, very different sort of population structure, different amounts of money, opened a new library in 2002. Brighton opened its new Jubilee Library in 2003. The London Borough of Tower Hamlets has its new idea stores, not libraries, idea stores. These are, of course, all very different in their costing and in their design. A writer in the Sunday Times last February described the Tower Hamlets idea stores as a noisy souk of a place, contrasting it with Brighton's aspiring to lofty expression of civilized values as much as a place to borrow words and images. While reading that, I wasn't quite sure where that leaves Tower Hamlets in the scale of civilized values. But if we are indeed in a generation that all of a sudden is rebuilding and developing libraries, whether in well-heeled Dorset, inner city London, what are we building for? Before I turn to this, I remind you of a library of a kind that's nearer to everyday university experience than perhaps most of us here. The University of Utrecht recently opened a new library built on the outskirts of the town, where land is presumably cheaper, after much heart-searching and not a little dismay from those who work in the departments within the middle of the town. It's a glass palace by another fashionable firm. It's a library also that's trying to look aggressively towards the future and the immediate need for increasing electronic communication and access. One result in the view of many readers has been that the space available to use books has actually been neglected. Another more architectural complaint is that people who suffer from vertigo can't get to some of the stacks because you have to go across a bridge at a high level. I want to turn from these preliminary reminders of some of the more celebrated recent libraries to reflect on what we are building for. I'm assuming two things. The growth in electronic resources is, of course, very much to be welcomed and will continue to grow. We shall see no diminution in the numbers of books published on paper. If the numbers of conventionally published academic titles, as distinct from the insatiable more general demand for books on gardening and cookery and so forth, do go down, it won't be the result only of e-environments, but because of economic constraints in the book trade brought on by the consequences of patterns in library budgets, in changes to national, state, and educational funding, and because of changes in, for example, requirements for the RAEs. What are libraries buying? What are they expected to buy? How are they funding their acquisitions? How far can they expect to store them? Where and for how long? I speak here as a librarian. This year, one large academic, mainly scientific library in the University of London is faced with a serious proposal that all its bookstock should be outhoused in the country, not in the suburbs, in the country. and that only electronic resources should be on site. That would clearly not only save expensive space in central London, it would also serve as a clear statement of the ethos that this particular institution wishes to convey to students, researchers, and visitors. Whether it's the best for its subjects that are there is another matter altogether. Libraries no longer buy most of what they get, at least in terms of their budget. They rent. In the past, we bought copies of, for example, journals, we bound them up, we put them on the shelf. Purchasing, processing, binding, storage, data handling costs, building costs could all be calculated, subject to inflation, as part of a decision on whether or not to subscribe in the first place. You could keep what you bought. But now, if you subscribe to an electronic version of a journal, you have access to it, both the current year and the past years bundled with it, only for so long as you keep up your subscription. You have, of course, no control over the medium term, let alone the long-term costs. You have no control over your costs beyond the current year. You do, however, save on building costs. So the problem, therefore, like librarians trying to design libraries in the future as to where exactly to put their money. We don't buy access to some of what are now the most heavily used databases in the historical disciplines. Ebo, Echo, English Poetry, the Oxford DMB. Though, of course, you can also buy the ODMB in hard copy. When we look at the delivery end, we find further discrepancies with what we are used to in libraries. Many scientists make great play of how little they now need to visit a library. Everything, they say, is available to them in their labs or their offices, or on screen. Something very similar might be claimed for lawyers, though here much depends on the subject area of your work. But scientific journals published on paper are not dying by the dozen. Each year sees new titles launched by the major publishers, as well as by a host of small institutions, entirely, or alternatively, on paper. And so for the present, librarians have to face the fact the two media must exist and be paid for side by side, and that affects the future of libraries and the looks. Some quite obvious things. For computer terminals, we obviously don't need the same kind of space that we do for books, nor do we need the same ceiling heights in a catalogue room that we do for cards. We do need air conditioning, or at least air cooling, as a counter to the heat generated by most computers and their servers. Our energy bills keep on going up, even as the price of energy, as we've all been told all too clearly in the last few days, keeps going up and will keep going up for the foreseeable future. When we look at shelving, we don't find ourselves anymore in a world where we could build as high as we want. We now have to be controlled by legislation concerning disability access, wide aisles, shelves at a height that could be reached from a chair, and so forth. These issues, quite apart from the controversial ones concerning what's happened to the older book stocks, some of it for sale, for example, in Charing Cross Road, are readily available in the new public library in Brighton, if you look at the pictures of that. It's been widely admired by the architectural and the library professionals. The same is true in Peckham. Libraries built to specifications for new personal needs. Questions of floor loading suddenly become very different. And the old standard calculations of books per square meter as a means of estimating fugitive building costs become out of date. My passing reference to Charing Cross Road, still one of the centres of the British second-hand book trade, brings me to a topic that will most certainly develop further in the next few years, and that directly affects library buildings, their look, and everything else to do with them, because it concerns space. We've become used to the idea of deaccessioning, even if we are very far from used to the scale of it on which it can happen, or the value of the books that can be put into the skip, whether in South Wales or in East Anglia. On far too many occasions, we have seen books and other materials deaccessioned without thought as to how they fit into what's been called, albeit inadequately, the National Printed Archive, an archive for which we hold joint responsibility. It is not something which we can leave just to the British Library. All libraries have to have a deaccessions policy. The important thing about these policies is they should not only reflect the needs of the institution, but also have some regard for the social and intellectual community. There have been some notorious decisions, as at Kiel and in Manchester, and some narrow escapes, for example, in York and Minster. Great public libraries built on 19th century wealth have discarded books on a scale and of a kind that's reduced the bibliographical and therefore historical foundations of their local communities. Liverpool, Norwich, Wigan, Stoke Newington, Lambeth, Cheltenham. It doesn't matter how much money you've got or where you are. You get rid of your books. We may expect continuing public anxiety on such activities. In academic libraries, we may also expect in the next few years to see a wholly different kind of deaccessioning, even on a different scale. In a world where not only much of the older material, and that includes everything published in the 20th century, is no longer in everyday use, but also where we see determined efforts in large-scale projects for retrospective scanning, whether under the auspices of commercial firms such as Google, or under quasi-foundations such as JSTOR, or under those of national libraries such as Gallica in France, we see quite new horizons. The purpose of all these, of course, is to make materials more widely and quickly, as we saw this morning, available. For libraries, there seems at last to be an answer to the long-standing problem of expensive duplication with other libraries. We can not just save space, we can also save the trouble of having to look after these books. Runs of periodicals and newspapers decay. They demand space, they demand conservation money. The obvious question, the one that must be addressed by all university libraries in the next very few years, is how much do we need this duplication? By investing in electronic access, we can discard meters, if not kilometers, of books, make space for the books of today, avoid the need for new buildings, and simply refurbish the regained space in what we already have. In an extreme form, we can ask whether we even need libraries, let alone librarians. Or so one kind of argument runs. In fact, of course, there's a way forward that moves between the extremes, but we can be sure that many libraries will now rid themselves of their runs of periodicals, and that for the most part, these runs are of no commercial value. And let's pause in these utopian dreams. Does all this actually help our research? Or does it merely replace one kind with another? Do we read like this? Does the historian work like this? While without doubt there have been two major revolutions with the advent of e-publication and the much wider availability of texts and the ability of researchers to search and review materials and resources on a scale and in ways hitherto impossible to imagine, even in a whole career of international travel, the importance of older collections of books, print, and manuscript remains undiminished. Evidence, whether historical or contemporary, depends on artifacts. For anyone working on early modern Britain, the use of Ebo has become almost second nature. But it's worth thinking about what exactly is being used. A digitized copy of a microfilm of an original, a surrogate of not one, but two removes. Not all the bibliographical identifications that have been made in the course of the microfilming program, which dates back to the 1930s, are accurate. Not everything in a given book has necessarily been filmed in the first place. It can be difficult to judge scale, type size, page size, and engraved illustrations are not reproduced adequately. There can, of course, be no sense of questions relating to materiality, such as judging the quality of the paper or determining the use of red ink in highlighting by the printers. Nor can there be any sense of the history of any particular copy. For although this is a copy of one particular book presented to you on Ebo, on screen, and sometimes it's even an amalgam of two books where the microfilm project could not find one complete copy, there's no sense of the binding, no sense of provenance. The copy-specific information that lies at the heart of historical evidence, and that is a key to understanding mortalité, is only partially reproduced. And of course, in looking at just one copy, we are ignoring one of the key characteristics of early printing, that books are apparently identical, but are in practice constantly different. Now, all these issues relating to the future of libraries, what we should keep in them and how we design them and pay for them, are not equally germane at all times, but they are for some purposes some of the time. And we witness in such constructions of surrogates what is, in fact, a very old-fashioned view of evidence. What I say of Ebo applies to a very large extent to other projects. Besides this, historians do not necessarily think in the ways that are constructed screen by screen. How much do we need to be aware of contexts as we search large files of text for individual terms? Just as in the electronic versions of library catalogues we lose that sense of bibliographic context as we search for individual items, so in searching files of text we may not be able to recover the three-dimensional spatial contexts of the passage that engages our attention at a particular moment. All this is quite apart from the difficulties that are now widely acknowledged in ensuring that electronic files remain accessible. We've touched on that this morning. This summer's British Library strategy document, redefining the library, alluded to substantial technical challenges associated with long-term storage of the electronic record, to which everybody could only say amen. For libraries, this means economic uncertainties of several kinds. It also is a reminder that there are very great dangers in too rapid a transition from paper to computer file. Yet, in contrast, Google is seeking to offer a future of a kind that can seem almost reassuring. The initiative to capture several million books from half a dozen libraries has been widely, if incompletely, reported in the press. In its recent books, Cambridge University Press has adopted the practice of printing on the verso of its title pages the following statement. Cambridge University Press has no responsibility for the persistence or accuracy of URLs from external or third-party internet sites referred to in this book, and does not guarantee that any content on such websites is or will remain accurate or appropriate. Well, you can hear the lawyers talking there, but it's an important reminder that much of our work is now published both on paper and as web pages, the two complementing each other. We are a long way from those days, not so many years ago, when the same space was used for statements, but the book had been printed on permanent paper. There's also one great assumption in much of what I've been saying in the last few minutes. I've concentrated on the relationship between what we might call the old print and the new screen. Yet many kinds of information exist only on screen. Most web pages have no relation at all to print. The question of surrogates and alternatives is of mounting importance, but it is not the largest. Let's return to the British Library report I alluded to. It was criticised, even mocked, slightly unfairly, in the TLS for allegedly mentioning the word book just once. That's to miss the point about a much greater danger in the way we think about libraries, their future, and their future appearance and design. This further point is encapsulated in another sentence in the same report that actually seeks to reassure the scholarly world on whose support the British Library depends. And the report said, although the Google generation expects swift and easy access online to all the information it wants, researchers are clear that there will always be some fields of study where they will continue to need access to the real documents in traditional reading rooms. Well, it was that sentence actually that worried me more than anything else in the whole report. Reading rooms are, of course, no longer traditional, whatever traditional means. You can glance through the door at any of the British Library reading rooms and you will instantly see that there's no relation at all to the old round reading room. More crucially, we touch here on two topics concerning the nature of evidence. First, evidence of the kind that seems to be assumed here, the manuscript and printed documents that we like to call original, can only be tested in artifacts whose status is itself subject to examination. That was the point of an outburst by Professor Thomas Tansell at the Guggenheim Foundation in 1998 on what he called a failure of perception on the part of library managers. The same argument applies to all fields of studies, not just to some. The choice of British Library wording that reveals a management seeking, I think, to divide and rule. Secondly, and in some ways even more oddly, the term real documents immediately poses the question of the status and nature of documents that exist only online. Are they not real? Have they no legal, factual, or other evidential value? The emails that have got the present government into such trouble time and time again are real enough. Let's stop pretending and think a little harder in our libraries about how we use all kinds of knowledge, in all kinds of formats, in different ways, side by side. In all this, there's a very strong message for the future of libraries and their future appearance. At the start of this paper, I deliberately drew attention to several different kinds of recently built libraries, or libraries under discussion, in the British National Park, in rundown South London, in well-heeled South Coast towns, in a major provincial city, in the Netherlands. The point of this was not to emphasize that different communities require and expect different kinds of libraries. That's been self-evident since medieval, even ancient times. Rather, it was to raise the questions, how fast do different kinds of libraries need to change, and how far should they change? That's what we're here for today. Thank you.